What do you think, folks? Pretty good video, huh? That was Scott Guyette and Sleeping Dog Productions. And welcome back. I was here this morning. I was here yesterday, day before, and I appreciate you all being here. The crowd seems to be growing, and that's a very good thing. This is a very unique opportunity that we have today. I'm not sure we've ever done the Zoom the way we're doing it with Kurt. And Kurt, welcome. Glad to see you again. Thank you very much for being here. He's going to be kind of our local, no, I shouldn't say, our long-range expert. And I'll say now, Kurt, if you hear something that you think is maybe incorrect or, in the Air Force, we used to call it the BS flag, okay? So if you see or hear something, just you can wave your finger, and we'll make believe that's, and we'll come back to you. We all know who he is at this point. The rest of the team here that we've got, and we've really got two teams. We've got two airplanes, two teams, and we're going to be talking about each one. Each one is a little bit different. The acquisition, the airplanes themselves, and we're going to ask Kurt in a little bit to just get into some of the history. I had a Zoom call with Kurt, about a week ago or so, and he is an absolute wealth of information. And I'll say now, the way things are going to work, we're going to talk about Kurt first with a little bit of the history of the airplane, its inception, its evolution. Then we're going to get into, each airplane and the acquisition of each airplane, what happened to it? How did it go down? Where did it go down? How did we get it here? The restoration of the airplane, talk to some of the pilots of the airplane, do a little bit of a walk around on the airplane, and then we're going to open it up to questions. And with the questions, Kurt's going to be part of that also. So we've got again, a wealth of information here available to us, and please be patient with us. I'm not a professional at this. Connie talked me into it, a couple years ago, I guess. And if you remember that voice that you just heard on the video, that was David Hartman. And something that David told me was, when you do this kind of stuff, Ed, you probably only want to have like three guys up here. And well, do the math, because right now we've got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and Kurt. So we've got 6 right now. So it's going to be, a little bit of a challenge for me, but I'm going to do my best. And I'll start with just basic introductions here. The first guy I got on my left, his name is Doc Winters. He is the owner of, let's see, eeny, meeny, miny, that one right there, okay? That is his. He is the pilot of it also. And I asked him briefly. I hate guys like this because they're overachievers. You know, he goes to school, he gets a medical degree, then he decides, oh, no, I want to go out and be a fighter pilot. So he goes through OCS with the Navy, turns into an F-18 pilot, and then comes back and, becomes an eye doctor, correct? Okay, an ophthalmologist. Now he's got a warbird. So that's the guy here, and we're going to be asking him for some numbers and impressions of the airplane. But that's our first guy, and I'll just ask him to introduce the guy alongside him, who's the second member of the team.
Am I on?
You're on.
This is Mike Vadaboncure. He runs Midwest Aero Restorations, and they're responsible for this beautifully restored original aircraft. And Dave Young and Steve Schultz are out there too. The three of them basically did it all.
Okay, thank you. Jim Martinelli is next, Director of Operations, Erickson Aircraft. He, again, is responsible for a great deal of that airplane over there. So, Jim, I'll let you introduce your team.
Yeah. Next to me is Doug Griffin. Doug is our 109 pilot. He's acquired a lot of 109 time this summer. He's flown the 109 from Oregon all the way to Detroit and then back to here. And next to him is David Reed, our Director of Maintenance. And David is responsible for the mechanical restoration of the 109.
Okay, thanks for the introductions. And Kurt, I'm going to turn it over to you for a minute here and just let you give somewhat of a history of the airplane, its inception, what it was supposed to do at first, and how it evolved to, these beautiful airplanes that we see in front of us.
Yeah, okay. Well, it's a Messerschmitt. So everything starts with Willy Messerschmitt, its designer. He was only 36 years old when the ME-109 took off for its first flight. A guy who was obsessed with lightweight and low drag engineering, a guy who was obsessed with optimized airframe structures. Just to give you a practical example, and I'm pretty confident, for example, Michael Padevoqueur might elaborate more on that. If you have a look at the attachment points of the main landing gear, these also are the attachment points of the engine mounting, of the lower engine mounting. So when the plane touches to the ground, the forces that are imposed on the landing gear are neutralized by the momentum that comes from the engine. He was always thinking in ways to optimize airframe structures. And of course, a requirement that came from the Luftwaffe was it should be the plane, the fighter plane should be easily road and rail transportable. Having in mind that if you crash land a plane, it should be easy to be recovered and brought back to operations as soon as possible. The production history is also an important point. The ME-109 was relatively easy to produce. So all in all, I think 33,000 have been produced. With only a handful to survive, and to my knowledge only one example, which is totally original, which had been recovered by the Royal Air Force in the North African desert in 1942 and then kept by the Imperial War Museum in London, and had been flying until I think 15 years ago. That was Willy Messerschmitt, who had in mind to build a lightweight fighter. And on the customer side, so to say, at the Luftwaffe, you also had two key people which were decisive for the ME-109's history. One of them was Ernst Udet, the second highest scoring ace in World War I after the famed Red Baron with 62 kills, being now the director of the technical office of the Air Ministry. And the other one was Robert von Greim, also a World War I ace, at 28 kills, who was heading the fighter department of the Air Ministry. These two guys had the intellectual capacity to draw the right conclusions from the incredible mass of dogfights they had in World War I. And the main conclusion was, dogfights are nothing for average pilots. Regardless of the nations, every nation had lost too many pilots in dogfights. So their idea of, let's have a fighter that is so superior that even an average pilot may score without being pulled into a dogfight, met Messerschmitt's passion for lightweight design. And that was the birth point of the 109. The outcome was a relatively light fighter with superior performance in dives and in climbs, and of course in acceleration and in speed, having a high-speed wing airfoil, which was not as as good performing at low speeds, but for that reason, Messerschmitt had designed mechanically operated slats, which you can see here on the airplanes, which were pushed into the leading edge of the wings when the airflow was tough enough, and which were popping out of the wings or slowly coming out of the wings when the airflow decreased. That helped to control the 109 in low speeds. As for the production history and as for the combat history, just a few brief remarks, and please, General, give me a sign when I'm going overboard. In the first 4 years of the 109's operational history, everything seemed to be confirmed by the war in Spain and by the war in Poland and in France. But there, the 109 only met inferior opposition, like Russian biplanes or relatively slow Polish or French fighters, which had something between 50 to 80 knots less top speed than 109. And then it was easy, of course, to go for hit and run combats, and all of these planes were easy prey for an average Messerschmitt pilot. The whole thing turned with the Battle of Britain. There, the 109 met Hurricanes and Spitfires. And now look at the Spitfire. The Spitfire was a dogfighter by design. Look at that beautiful elliptical wing. Look at the higher wing area, which made the Spitfire maneuverable over a much wider range of speed. That was the reason why, in an infuriated debate with the chief of the German Luftwaffe, Hermann Göring, one of the wing commanders of the German Luftwaffe, later to become General of Fighters, Adolf Galland, upon Göring's question, "Galland, what do you need to really cope with the Britons?" replied, "Give me a squadron of Spitfires." Because there, dogfight was back on the top of the agenda again, and the 109 was not much of a good dogfighter. It could be easily outturned by the Spit. For that reason, Messerschmitt tried to turn the 109 into a dogfighter, and that was the so-called Friedrich version, or Fox in today's alphabet. The Fox was modified massively. It was lightened even more. The wing armament had been done away with. The Fox got a centralized armament consisting of only two small caliber machine guns on top of the engine and one gun, one cannon, 30 millimeter cannon, firing centrally through the spinner. The spinner had been smoothened, the cowling had been smoothened, the elevator struts had been done away with, the landing, the tail wheel had been made retractable. So here you had the best you could get in airflow of a 109, and for the dyed-in-the-wool dogfighters of the Luftwaffe, of which Gunther Rohl was one, whom Connie had mentioned before, the F version really was what they longed for. I once talked about the F and the several 109 versions with Gunther Rohl, and he said, "You know, Kurt, flying the F in combat, that was like foil fencing. That was really a capable weapon in the hand of a man who has seat of the pants, who has good spatial orientation, and who is a capable deflection shooter." That was the F. Then the tides turned. Germany was in the defensive. The 109, which was originally designed for being just a pure fighter, became assigned multi roles, fighter bomber, all the like. The heavy weapons returned because they had to fight the B-17s, and then it was obvious by 1943-1944 it had reached the end of its development potential. It's still in the hands of a capable pilot. It still was a respectable weapon. But in the hands of an average pilot, it was not a match for the Mustangs and for other Allied fighters anymore. General, I hope I wasn't too long.
I lost my mic. Oh. And you guys knew all that, right? You knew, yeah. They're just nodding their head, going, "Yeah, okay." Thank you, Kurt. And please stand by. We're going to have some more questions for you for sure. But that gives you a quick idea of where the airplane came from, you know. And me being a former Air Force fighter pilot, that's the kind of airplane I'd want to fly back then. It's like, hey, you know, if I'm a mediocre fighter pilot, what do I want? I want a better airplane so I can beat the other guy out there. And not only that, but he mentioned the fact that, hey, you know, does he want a dogfight with a guy? No, you don't want a dogfight with a guy. You want to kill him, hey, on a, you know, either a high deflection gunshot and get out of there, or the current day, you know, hey, these F-22s, you know, they're blowing the other guys up 30 miles away and the other guy doesn't even know they're there. So yeah, what he says absolutely makes sense for that era. And then, hey, we get down to the actual airplanes right now. And I'm going to start with Doc and just say, The first question that I have is acquiring this airplane. It's got a very interesting story. I think you all will appreciate it. So, Doc, go ahead. Give me an idea of where this thing came from.
So, like he said, there's 33,000, but there are very few able, actual, authentic restorations left in the world. Most of the ones you've read about are E-models. That Black 6 he discussed 15 years ago was started in the 70s and 80s, and it flew for about 15 years in England, and then they stopped flying, and it was truly authentic, too. This was recovered from a lake in Estonia. It was the former Eastern Front for the Germans as they were retreating in 1944. Lake Swilbo in 1990, the pilot was returning to his base and was hit and mortally wounded the airplane. He was okay. He just set it down on a lake, slid out on that ice lake to the very western edge, and jumped out and ran west. And it sank as the spring thaws came in 1944, and no one ever recovered or no one knew about it until after the wall came down and the Russians decided to make some money and sell some things. They pulled this out in 1990 and took it to Moscow and showed it around for a little while, and then it changed hands about five times and ended up not a lot done to it, just the original, all the original parts, airframe, everything, just changed hands. No one really restored it until we did. We got it from a gentleman in Munich in 2012, and it took 10 years.
Wow. And then the restoration started, and how long was the restoration process?
10 years.
They
produced the most beautiful Mustangs in the entire world, and they did the Happy Jacks Go Buggy for me, and to transition and try to translate as a mechanical engineer into a totally different language, totally different tooling, totally different aspect. It was a really rough and challenging ball game for them, and they did it really well.
Okay,
and
what model is this? Is this?
It's a G6.
It's a G6, okay. And I look, does it have leading edge slats on it?
It has aerodynamic slats. They're based on basically aerodynamic forces. They'll deploy or not, depending upon what the wing sees as far as air.
Okay, and I'll ask Kurt, how does that compare with the E that you were just talking about? Is this the next generation, if you will? Is this a better airplane than that E model that you were just talking about?
Yeah, well, the G6, of course, picked up weight because it had got heavier armament. It was a capable airplane still, but it had to fulfill too many purposes for its original design. It had to serve as a fighter against other fighters. It had to serve again as a fighter against other bombers. That is that explains the heavier armament. And it wasn't as easy to fly due to its increased takeoff weight as the E and the former versions and the F had been. The slats were a special thing. I recall a talk with Günter Rahl, who was so much a fan of the 109F, but he never got really familiar with the slats, being a dogfighter, you know. In high bank turns, the lower wing slat used to pop out when the airflow decreased, while the higher wing slat still had been pressed into the leading edge, which finally ended up in the airplane flipping over just when you were about to get the other guy. So for a while, Gunther had the slats riveted into the leading edge of the wing to make good for that. But as the war in the East advanced and they were forced to move forward and forward to smaller airfields, to soft ground airfields, he could not just do away with the slats because there he needed low landing speeds.
Understand. Thank you. All right, Jim, how about acquisition of your airplane? What, can you tell us that story?
Yeah, so...
Am I on? Our airplane is actually was born as a Spanish Bouchon and was flown by the Spanish military until the movie The Battle of Britain. And at that time, the movie production acquired most of the Spanish Air Force's 109s and Heinkel 111s to produce the movie Battle of Britain. One of the pilots who flew in the Battle of Britain movie was Connie Edwards. At the end of the production, Connie ended up with a large amount of those airframes of the 109s, brought them to Texas, stored them in Texas, and over the years, various collectors were able to get them. In the early 1990s, Mr. Erickson, who owns the airplane, struck a deal with Connie and purchased the airplane and brought it to Oregon and just assembled it and put it on static display. And in 2015, the decision was made to make it airworthy. And took us about 20 months to do what you see here from what we got.
Okay, talk about the engine a little bit. I think there's been some engine changes on this airplane, haven't there?
Yeah, so Dave will be able to give you more in depth on that. But when we were doing the airplane, the Merlin-powered Bouchon is kind of a... It just doesn't, you know... It doesn't appeal to that clean 109 look. So Mr. Erickson was thinking, you know, let's try to do something to get closer to what you see here with the Docks airplane. The decision was made to try an Allison. We mocked the Allison up in front of the airplane. We borrowed some G10 cowling from a friend of ours. And we realized we were able to put the Allison literally inside of unmodified G10 cowling. And the prop shaft ended up in the same exact location as where it was on the G10. So engineering was done to develop an engine mount and that stuff. And we put the Allison in it. And here it is.
The rest is history, huh?
Yeah.
Huh. All right. How about Doc? Talk about your motor a little bit. What's in that thing?
It's an original Daimler-Benz 605 Alpha, and it obviously is original because they didn't make any 605s after the war, so all the Daimler-Benzes you see flying are original engines. And there are several in Bouchons or closer airframes in Germany flying now, but they're very, very rare engines, and Mike Nixon spent a great deal of time and effort and is quite expert at restoring 605s and German engines. And this is probably his seventh or eighth, at least, 605 Daimler-Benz engine.
Wow, okay. I gotta ask Kurt, how about, what's the reputation of that motor, of the 605? Was it a good motor? Did it, and how many hours could you expect out of it before you had to rebuild it? What was the opinion of the pilots of the motor?
Well, the pilots, of course, were very fine with the engine because it was, to my knowledge, the first airplane engine in mass production that comprised a mechanical fuel injection. That is, it was not really subject to negative Gs. So if you had to evade from a fight, you just pushed the stick and then you were gone. While with the carburetor-fueled Merlin engines of the British, for example, you had to avoid negative Gs, else your engine would go off for a couple of seconds. So the pilots always were very fine with the engine, but its reliability, of course, depended on the theater of war the airplane was in. You must imagine that if you fought on the very far southeast of the front in Europe, say on the Black Sea, the supply lines were pretty long. Due to the changing climate conditions, a sensitive engine like this high power 2,100 cubic inch 12 cylinder was not easy to maintain, because just due to logistical affairs, or it flew also in the deserts of Africa, and there the time between overhaul was in the double digits.
How about temperatures? You mentioned it. Was it better in the cold? Was it better in the hot? Does it overheat on the ground? I know some of these airplanes do have problems in that regard. Does this have any of those problems?
Yeah, that might be it might be better to ask one of the guys who really are the engine experts for that.
You guys who fly it, any problems, you know, hey, getting the thing started and you know, having to get it off the ground because it gets hot?
Well, the high time pilot that I know of now in the world is a gentleman named Klaus Plaza in Germany, and he has 350 some odd hours, and he used to tell me it's about 8 to 12 minutes, depending on conditions, between startup and it over temps and you can't take off.
Okay.
Regardless of really ambient temperature and or facing the wind or downwind or whatever, it's, you just don't have a lot of time. And it's my understanding that the Spitfires are the same way. Those early airplanes, the Mark I, Mark II, they were designed to squadron, to basically leave the assembly point, jump in your airplane and take off the grass, whichever direction you were. There was not a lot of Oshkosh taxiing.
Yeah. I understand. Mustangs have that problem too here a little bit, I think. But all right, good. Well, in that case, let's get into some of the pilot stuff, as Maverick or Goose would say, I guess, huh? And that movie, I think, is going to be out here on Friday night. I think they got Top Gun Maverick being shown. But anyway, in that regard, flying time. Who's got the most flying time in this thing? Yeah, they're pointing fingers. Okay, what do you think? Easy airplane to fly, tough airplane to fly? You know, I just look at the landing gear and the distance to the tail. It looks a little bit close coupled, but not bad. Is it an easy tail dragger to fly or a hard tail dragger to fly?
No, you're absolutely right. That's my first impression as well. You look at the airplane, it's very intimidating. You know, evil-looking airplane, and it's like, I don't know if I'm not so sure I want to fly it. It's intimidating, but I figured I'd give it a shot, and I got in it, and I absolutely love the airplane. It's not what you read about in the books in terms of landing mishaps and stuff. I just the way I fly it is just that, you know, slow it up. You know, I'm probably about 120 knots on base, slowing up to about 110 on short final, and probably 90 over the numbers. And I just hold it off until it's done flying in a three-point attitude. And once it hits the ground, well, you can put your feet on the floor. It doesn't do anything weird.
You prefer doing a three-point to a wheel landing?
Oh, yeah, I would not wheel land this airplane.
Okay.
No, I would... I think it would be, you know, with the gear geometry the way it is, yeah, and changing with the nose up and down, it would be a handful. Yeah. And plus, you look at it, you know, the way how far forward the gear is, and the tail is really heavy, mm-hmm, on the ground. Weight-wise, it is really heavy. So to have the tail up in the air, if the main's on the ground, you're going pretty good clip. So.
Okay, how about just basic cruise? First airspeeds, how fast, you know, if you're cruising to come to Oshkosh, what were you cruising at?
Well, looking at FlightAware, I was doing about 250 knots, 240 knots,
okay,
across the ground.
Okay.
About 210 indicated.
Okay. And how much gas are you burning? How many gallons an
hour?
Both
the Allison were burning 60 gallons an hour.
Okay.
Yeah.
And how about Doc and yours? Same thing?
Well, it's a 605. Kirk can correct me if I'm wrong. It's a much bigger engine than the Merlins and Allisons as far as displacement. I believe it's more in line with the class of the Griffin, so it inherently, since it's a bigger engine, it's going to use more fuel. And we're really young in the program, so we're not, don't have quite the numbers, but I'm sure it's in the 70s at least. Mm-hmm. But it's very quick across the ground as far as when you true it out nicely. And I run in all the German instruments in there, so I run in kph and kilometers, etc. Mm-hmm. But as far as the landing and characteristics and all that, you know, it was designed, like Kurt said, to basically disassemble it with three or five guys, put the wings on the side, put it on a rail car, and go to where the front was. Because it's a very short-ranged fighter. It does not have a lot of gas, can't go anywhere, really. So, and that was an Achilles heel for it, of course, right at the Battle of Britain. They really found that out. But go back again. I was always thinking before I started flying it, I mean, you're not going to build a fighter for 10 years, 35 to really 45, they were putting them back together still with us bombing them. You're not going to build 33,000 if they're just an animal. I mean, they've got to be a good airplane, both takeoff, landing, and up in flight. And it is. And then the little experience I've had great people talking to me, like Klaus Plaza, on how to fly it. And I fly it in really nice conditions. And if you're staying on it, it's just fine. It tracks nicely. It sets down at 3-point just beautifully. It flies around the pattern like it lives there. So I find it to be quite enjoyable.
Okay. We've talked about acquisition. We've talked about a little bit about the restoration. I'll talk to the restoration guys here just a second and ask, what was the most difficult part about restoring these things? And I don't care anybody. All of it? Okay. I mean, parts are probably not readily available, and if you do find them, they're probably very expensive, or you got to manufacture them yourself. Yeah, I would think it would be a tremendously difficult process.
Yeah, everything you've said is right on. And, you know, another aspect that we've had to deal with was dealing with where these airplanes were built. And so we're dealing with people in Germany and Austria and some in the UK.
Careful now. We're dealing with people in Germany. Yeah.
And they've been a fantastic help. I mean, we wouldn't have been able to do it without our friends in Germany and Austria, who have some corporate knowledge of operating these types of airplanes. So we could have done it without them. And like I said, we had our own set of challenges here. But when we run out of a part or we run into a roadblock, it's like, well, where do we go? Here in the States, I know where to go for P-51s and so forth, over to Europe. So that added the complexity. There was more of time. How long is it going to take for them to make it, or have they made it, or how long is it going to get here, and are they really understanding what I am asking? So that's something we dealt with for 10 years.
I understand. How about gas? How much gas? Are both the same? How much does each one airplane hold?
Ours holds about 105 gallons.
Okay.
Yeah, ours is close to about 108, 110.
Same. So yeah. You're right. It's really a short-range kind of airplane. You're not going to be up there very long. And, interesting. All right. Other points of note, I guess, from a flying standpoint. You guys maneuvered, done acro, is it a high G airplane? What's the G limit on these things? I know you're not going to take them up there, but when they were brand new, what was the G limit? Are we talking, you know, 5-7 Gs, something like that?
About 5 Gs on the airframe.
Okay. And you don't do that anymore, probably, right? I mean, most of the time.
We'll do aerobatics in it. No, it's a very nice flying airplane.
Okay. And are you guys flying at all during the show here? Are you going to be, I don't know the answer to that. No? You guys, okay, so you're not going to see an ME-109 fly. All right. I'm going to turn it over to Kurt here for a minute because I know he's got some stories about a guy who flew these airplanes for a long time, was very successful, and I'm curious, Kurt, your relationship with that German ace named Gunther. I know you were involved with a book about Gunther. I know you've got a wealth of information involving the guy. I wish I'd had the opportunity to meet him, but you got a quick story about Gunther Rall, and I'll let you describe exactly who he is if the crowd doesn't know.
Yeah, well, Gunther Rall was one of the leading aces of World War II, having scored 275 kills. So I think he's the third highest scoring ace in the history of air warfare. If you have met him, you would have been surprised to have a relatively small, introvert, vivid, but not very extrovert or not very bragging or pretending guy, you know? For me, he was the typical size of a fighter pilot. I cannot tell you in inches, but it was about 1 meter, 75 centimeters. That seemed to be something like the standard size of a German fighter pilot, because guys of that size fitted exactly into the 109's cockpit. You should not be 6 feet tall. That's a bit too much for that airplane. And of course, he was like all fighter pilots when we were talking about air combat. He needed at least three hands to show you how things happen in the air. I got to know him, I think, very well. And you know, if you have to do with these World War II fighter pilots, they all start with those old, colorful war stories. But if you get to know them better, you also get to know the more thoughtful side of these people and the way they think about war. And one thing that comes to my mind was when we were writing Gunther's biography, we were doing it in his beautiful home in Bad Reichenhall. And we had a working day with everything laid out on his kitchen table, as all fighter pilots. He wasn't very much of a guy that was happy to fill binders or something like that. He had everything, all the documents stored in a chest. And then we put it on the table, and I tried to sort it out while a recording device was on the table and we were talking about it. And then it was up to me to put that into proper German language. So we had a heavy working day. And after that was done, we were sitting on the porch. He poured every one of us a glass of whiskey. And for a while, we were saying nothing. And then I turned over to him and I saw tears running from his face. And I said, in these days, we were already on a first name basis. I said, Gunther, what's the matter? And he says, you know what the real thing is about war? Of the 275 guys I've killed, I saw the faces of at least 200. And they haunt me at night because they were my age, they were looking like me, and we were, when we were turning in on the Eastern Front, the combat altitudes were so low, you did not have to wear an oxygen mask, so you could really see the other guy. And you knew in 2 or 3 minutes it would be over, finally, for one of you, either him or you. And with age, this haunts me more and more and keeps me awake at night. And this was the other side of the guy. He could talk brilliantly about air combat, even after World War II. He flew the FO-104. He introduced, in fact, the FO-104 to the German Air Force, and he had amassed a considerable number of hours in the FO-104. So he really represents quite a part of aviation, military aviation history, and he always was a fighter pilot, but he was also a very, very thoughtful guy.
Thank you. Interesting perspective, and something I don't think any of us knew of that man. I would ask, though, you mentioned the number of kills. I think people would be interested to know, yeah, he shot down a lot of airplanes, but he was also shot down. Is that not correct?
Yeah, I think he had to bail out 8 times, and he had one severe crash landing in Russia, an occasion at which he broke his back 3 times. So that brought him into hospital for 9 months. And the good thing about that hospital stay was there he met his wife, who was a medical doctor in that hospital. So they married. And then, of course, he would have had the opportunity to withdraw. He would have had the opportunity to fly a desk somewhere in the Air Ministry. But he returned to his squadron on the Eastern Front because he, at the age of 24, for the other guys, was the old man. He was the one who was the squadron commander, and he knew very well. These guys relied on him as the old man. They were lost if he would not come back. So he returned to being a frontline pilot and had to fly with cushions for a while because when he touched down, that was very painful for him. And also in combat, high G, positive high G maneuvers were painful, but finally he adapted and he made his career until he had scored 275 kills. And at the age of 27, this also amazes me over and over again, at the age of 27, he was in command of a fighter wing that comprised something like 120 fighters and 2,000 men. So these guys really had received a crash course in leadership in wartime, and that at incredible loss rates. You know, he was one of the very few to survive who had flown in World War II from the first to the last day.
Okay.
If you met somebody like him, you know, the Gunther had something like 600 hours in missions, and on the 109. He still was a predator in such an airplane, though the 109 was by that time, by the end of the war, was technically inferior to a Mustang.
As I remember, he also lost his thumb. Is that not correct? Didn't he? He had his thumb shut off too. So quite an amazing man. All right, thank you, Kurt. We've got about 10 minutes left right now for the official program. I'm going to ask somebody in the group here to do a quick walk around, and we'll only do one airplane, so it doesn't really matter, but we got a, okay, eeny, meeny, miny, mo. Okay, looks like it's your turn.
Yeah, I'll go ahead and do ours. I'll get up. So ours is the Allison-powered G10 variant of a 109, which is converted from a Spanish Buchon here, what you see behind us. And a number of challenges that we had with restoring this particular aircraft was just fitting the engine, like Jim had mentioned earlier. And with a Curtiss electric propeller, it has all original G10 cowling that we sourced from Eastern Europe, and then also the parts. Something that we thought about for a long time is we always wanted it to look authentic when the cowling is closed. So the exhaust was one of the most difficult parts of the restoration, being how it's lower and the header manifold system that you see here. I mean, getting it to really come out in the same spot, using the induction scoop as the Allison's the downdraft carburetor. And another problem with running the Allison, like they were talking about earlier, is the overheating. And so we actually put oil coolers outboard of the landing gear wells as well, and had new radiators made by Pacific down in Southern California. But we found that we didn't end up not needing the oil coolers in the outer part of the wing because the radiators work so well in this airplane that the overheating issue is practically non-existent. Another neat feature of the later model G10s is the Erlo Hob canopy, which gets rid of the bars and the supports in the earlier canopies. It's a little bit lighter, and for better visibility. And then as you move farther aft, the tall tail, where you'll see the counterweight of the rudder goes through the vertical versus the short one, where the counterweight is part of the rudder itself and it eclipses the vertical. And they did that because of crosswind conditions and a little bit better maneuverability. But those were some of the biggest challenges other than installing the Allison engine for reliability. And that's the primary reason that we did it, so that we could fly it across the country from Oregon and display it for you today.